Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on into Thursday's edition of Kildare Focus. Taoiseach Micheál Martin is due to take to his feet and address the nation a little after 6 o'clock this evening with a sweeping easing of COVID-19 restrictions over a period of weeks. Concern is mounting, though, that it's too far too soon. I'll be discussing that in just a moment with Professor Gerry Killeen. Tom Parlin is Director General of the Construction Industry Federation, and CIF says some builders are poaching staff. I'll be talking to President Mark McGowan of Scholars Townhouse Hotel. Minister Pascal Donoghue has said the government will not re-examine the stay and spend scheme. I know an awful lot of people have criticised that as being very clunky. Mark, I'm sure, will have a view on that. As you've been hearing in our news bulletins, a record number of mortgage drawdowns in the first quarter of this year, levels not seen since the height of the Celtic Tiger. Charlie Weston, personal finance editor at the Irish Independent, joins me on that, and we'll be discussing whether or not foreign travel can or should resume from June with Owen Curry, editor of Air and Travel Extra, and of course a Strafford resident. As always, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with your comments, your requests, your dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97. You can drop us an email, studio@kfmradio.com, or tweet us at kfmradio. I think a lot of people, particularly those monitoring social media last night, will have been surprised, some pleasantly, some not so, at all the kites that were being flown after the COVID-19 Cabinet Subcommittee meeting in terms of the extent to which they were prepared to ease restrictions over the coming weeks. The formal announcement is due this evening, just after 6 o'clock, but all kites have been well and truly flown at this juncture. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Professor Gerry Killeen. He's AXA Research Chair in Applied Pathogen Ecology at the School of Biological, Earth and Environmental Sciences at UCC. Gerry, you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. You know, huge variety of restrictions being eased on a phase basis beginning May 4th. Then we have dates, May 10th, dates in June, and eventually to July, where we will look at returning to indoor dining and things like indoor sport. What's your view of what you have heard thus far? I mean, obviously, given the changing and fluid nature of case numbers, but does this seem like a reasonable timetable to you?
It just looks a bit rushed to me, and it just seems to be to be sailing a bit too close to the wind. We remain in a precarious position, and you know, we all know from experience that things can go quite wrong quite quickly. So, and more to the point, I think it's just a missed opportunity. The, you know, now that we have the vaccines on our side, a scale up is going well. You know, it puts us back in the zone where we can do what we did last summer, which is basically get rid of COVID and get ourselves back to a COVID-free existence. So, you know, with me, I'd just be a little bit more patient, and I'd take the opportunity to move from a defensive strategy to an offensive strategy and really go after this disease and stamp it out.
I mean, we've also seen today that a draft of the government's revised vaccine plan, which is not due for release until Tuesday, I believe, aims to see 2.5 million doses delivered by the end of May. That ramps up to 4 by the end of June and 6 million by the end of July. Would you prefer to wait until those 2.5 million doses have been delivered at the end of May, which is really only a 3-week difference in terms of the government's schedule?
Well, at least until then, because you know, we are dealing with now a virus that is bordering, you know, approaches measles in terms of transmissibility. And what that means is that the coverage targets you need to really squash transmission are very, very high. You know, for example, B117 is bad enough, but if it was P1, you would need 90% coverage of all age groups before you would expect to see transmission start to die off. So I would really hang in there, particularly as we do have some of these variants in the country. And yeah, there could be, I would really appeal for patience. And, you know, and a cool head, amongst our leaders. And then, you know, for all the rest of us, the other 5 million of us, just to, you know, just apply our own common sense and maybe let's not lose the run of ourselves when somebody allows us some of our freedoms. I'd be particularly careful with the meetings between households. You know, people should be, be measured in and ration those out, and also just do them in the smartest way possible.
One of the things that I was surprised to see, and I have to say, not a little on a purely personal basis, delighted, but surprised to see it at this particular point in the schedule, was the return of personal services, barbers, hairdressers, beauty salons from May 10th. And that is nothing to do with those particular services. It's more because it's an indoor service when we have been consistently told outdoor is safe and the rest of dining and everything like that is staying outdoors from May 10th at that point. Is that risky?
It wouldn't be at the top of my list of kind of early relaxations that I'd engage in. The other one, let's all be careful with the meetings between households as well, particularly, you know, we do have B117 and worse in the country. You know, once something like that gets into a household, it really spreads much quicker amongst all the household members. So, you know, let's all be careful.
And that, I suppose, additional caution, Gerry, for which you're calling, should kick in from May 10th, which is also the day that households were told will be allowed once again to meet outdoors among three households, but these can only be in gardens unless people are fully vaccinated. That kind of, I think from a purely rational standpoint, everybody can understand those kinds of caveats coming with meetings. You can meet here if you are vaccinated but the other person isn't. You can meet there if everybody else is vaccinated, and you can meet over yonder if nobody is vaccinated. I don't know, Gerry, that people are going to abide by those.
Yeah, I think it's premature. It's too convoluted, and you know, I prefer things simple. You know, with good, you know, margins for error on the safety. You know, like that when we do open, we really can do so safely. And for me, this is just sailing far too close to the wind. And I would be taking a much more measured approach. And you know, and then we can really, really let our hair down when the time comes. I think we'd all give our back teeth for a decent, normal, domestic summer, at least.
Mm.
And, you know, a good staycation with peace of mind and that worry gone. You know, because it's not just about the risks, it's also about the worry about, you know, what tomorrow brings, that I think is getting to a lot of people. And I think that would be the best mental health intervention of them all.
Professor Gerry Killeen, AXA Research Chair in Applied Pathogen Ecology at the School of Biological, Earth and Environmental Sciences at UCC. Thank you indeed for joining us. Now, I'll take you through the timetable as those kites have been flown. So, May 10th, we're told, return of personal services, the ban on inter-county travel will be lifted. Click and collect services may resume for non-essential retail, with a full reopening of retail expected in or around May 17th. Training for adults in pods of 15 for all sports can also resume from that date. That will be, I would imagine, non-contact outdoor. So from May 10th, also 50 people may attend a public mass, signalling a return to a public worship. There will still be restrictions on funeral and wedding gatherings outside of a church setting. Household visits are allowed once again among three households, but these can only be in gardens unless people are fully vaccinated. And the remaining facets of the construction industry that have been shut down can resume on that date. From May 17th, this is being flagged as the day which all non-essential retailers can open once again. June 2nd, hotels, guesthouses and B&Bs can open on that date and also permitted to serve food and drinks indoors to residents. June 7th, pubs and restaurants can serve customers outdoors. No distinction between pubs that serve food and those that don't. Gyms may also reopen at that date. And then I suppose everything else will be June and beyond, taken as the situation is at that time. But as I would was noting, you will have heard it in our main lunchtime news, concern mounting in government circles that this is just a little bit too quick. That concern echoed there by Professor Gerry Killeen. What's your instinct? What's your feeling? Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. Now, the Construction Industry Federation says some Irish builders are poaching one another's staff. I'm joined on the line to discuss this now by Director General of the Construction Industry Federation, Tom Parlin. Tom, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
I suppose this is, in other sectors, this might be referred to as poaching or headhunting, whatever way you want to look at it, but it's a particular difficulty now because construction is about to resume back full tilt, back full bore. So it really is all hands on deck.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of pressure going to be on. I suppose the disadvantage, the last sector, the government, closed down the sector, all of our essential workers, but that was a substantial amount of industry, maybe 40 to 50%, and then back on the 1st of April they opened up the residential side, so they left the commercial side out. Probably amounts to maybe 15 to 20,000 workers, a lot of big sites, a lot of office blocks, hotels, industrial buildings and so on. So those particular companies then found themselves at a disadvantage in that there was sufficient work around, they were looking for people to go working on the new residential operations going on, and likewise on the big sites, the likes of the Intels and the FDIs and so on. So, construction workers are hardy people who want to get up and work and earn a good day's pay. So they weren't likely to be sitting around under PUP. So there certainly was an element of them going to other companies, but probably a more worrying element in that they were leaving the country at the jurisdiction altogether to go to the north, go to the UK or go to the continent. So that is going to be a challenge now. We're expecting positive news this afternoon that the entire industry is going to be opened up from next Tuesday. So manning all those sites is going to be a challenge. I don't think there's going to be enough people around.
And it kind of seems to have fractured the sector. So it's pitted your larger operators against your smaller, pitted different kinds of construction against one another, and then pitted companies here against counterparts in the north, the UK and Europe, where restrictions are different and where construction was probably ongoing.
Yeah, well, first of all, Ireland is the only country that has had its construction sector closed down due to COVID. I'm in regular contact with my European colleagues right across the whole of Europe and on down into Turkey and so on, and they've all been operating fully. So, first of all, we were the only country closed down, but then the fact that it closed down parts of the industry and then they opened up another sector in terms of the residential and then eventually they left out a sector, it was quite divisive, it was quite unfair, and it frustrated a lot of our members. And it's been a difficult place within the CIF for the last while because, there was quite a bit of antagonism around. But thankfully, that's going to be over now. It is going to take a while for the recovery for the companies that have been closed down for over 16 weeks. They're going to take quite a bit of recovery. And unfortunately, not all of them will recover.
And of those that do recover, and we hope it's as large a proportion as is possible and feasible, they're going to face a race either to retain staff and to keep them on their books.
Excuse me. Well, I suppose the other side that is good, there's still pretty high unemployment. I just heard a piece on the media at lunchtime there about the aviation sector and how many people are out of work there. So there are other sectors. The hospitality sector isn't back yet. And I suppose maybe construction could be accused of poaching people out of there. But there are quite a high level of unemployment. So construction workers are badly sought after. I see ads. I see a big ad on one of the national dailies today looking for construction workers to go to a big project in the UK. So on the one hand, it's a good thing that construction workers and their skills are sought after. It is going to bring its own challenges. But there appears to be a lot of work now outstanding. There's a lot of houses that needed building. There's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built. And there's still a lot of foreign direct investment here and big projects that have been stalled for the last while.
So the net effect of this perhaps short-term fracturing of the sector, large versus small, kind of construction against kind of construction, may dissipate fairly quickly, or it may take a little while for its ripple effects to play out, if indeed they are permanent ripples.
Yeah, well, look, I suppose there's always competition between companies. They compete with each other for projects on tender price and so on. And there's a healthy market there for staff. Clearly, some of the people that have gone abroad, they were happy enough, I think, to be abroad when everything was closed down here. I know some individuals who are working down in the south of France, and quite happy to be down there when there was no GA or games or no opportunity to go out and have a drink. Now that the economy seems to open up, Ireland will become a much more attractive place, and I suspect that hopefully a good number of those will be tempted to come back into the workforce again here.
Tom Parlin, Director General of the Construction Industry Federation, thank you indeed for your time. I just want to expand upon a story that you would have heard in our 2 o'clock news headlines, and that is that Gardaí are appealing to anyone who wants to report a crime pertaining to their stay at a mother and baby home to contact them. Crimes relating to pregnancy or abuse can be reported via email, phone, or by calling to any local Gardaí station, and anyone who wants to report a crime will receive a personal contact within 48 hours. A dedicated Garda team has now been reviewed the report of the Mother and Baby Homes Commission to determine whether the information could form the basis for a criminal investigation. Garda are saying that after careful consideration, they are of the view that there is not enough detail in that very extensive Mother and Baby Homes Commission report to launch any criminal investigation because individuals are not identified. They're now appealing to anyone who wishes to report a crime related to their stay at a mother and baby home to contact them. Gardaí say they are fully aware of the profound impact on the lives of those affected and the concerns of the wider public. It says it will deal with any matters reported in a sensitive manner and will, where possible, progress matters through investigation. People can report a crime by emailing motherandbabyhomes@garda.ie or by phoning 1800 555 222. That's 1800 555 222. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about the stay and spend scheme.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
Now, the stay and spend scheme hasn't been the most well-received effort to boost the hospitality and tourism sector of which the government has ever conceived, but it is not going to change. Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue says it will not re-examine the stay and spend scheme. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Mark McGowan. He's owner and operator of Scholarstown House Hotel. Mark, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, how are you?
I think part of me feels we're being somewhat unfair to the stay and spend scheme because we were only able to use it for about 4 hours, and I'm being facetious, but it was available for use for a very, very scant amount of time. What's wrong with it from your viewpoint? How should it be reformed?
First of all, if we had been consulted at the beginning, we could have engaged with government and found out how it would have been more feasible. So there were a couple of issues that didn't really work out for us. First of all, it wasn't very practical in terms of having to download an app, take pictures, send receipts back, etc.
It's so very clunky, and that's also, Mark, sorry to talk across you, one of the reasons I would imagine that a lot of people didn't get on board with it. It feels like too much hassle. Also, what if I don't use smartphones? What if that area of tech is not something I engage in? So it's excluding a lot of people.
Exactly. It's made difficult. A stimulus plan like this should be a lot easier. It should be user-friendly for the consumer. What we were hoping for was something more similar to the idea they had up the north with restaurants. So it was an eat-out to help-out scheme where the business would get the money back at source, basically. So that would have been the idea. I think that would have been a lot more effective for businesses. And it also would have encouraged diners to get out and about. Now, I totally understand as well, Pascal Donoghue is in a position now where we're going to have a busy summer. So the idea is that this stimulus will be used during a quiet period, an off-peak season, basically. But I think that once the summer ends, there's going to be an initial mush, so to speak, for people and diners to get out and eat. But that will slow down. So I'm hoping it's going to be reviewed again come closer to September, again when it's off peak.
But an incentive scheme which most people either aren't aware of, don't know how to use, or aren't minded to use, isn't an incentive scheme.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
An incentive scheme that people either don't know how to use, couldn't be bothered using because it feels like too much hassle, or are excluded from using it, is not an incentive scheme.
Absolutely, it's not incentive whatsoever. Like, it needs to be practical, it needs to be user-friendly, and people need to know about it as well. Like, so there was no engagement from government between the general public on how this should be used, and make it simple. It has to be simplified and just made easier for people to use. And then it'll be beneficial to everybody. It'll be beneficial to the taxpayer because the economy will be moving a little bit faster, I suppose, and we'll be able to employ more people. We have 180,000 people unemployed, obviously, at the minute.
Mm.
We're hoping to get back indoors as soon as we possibly can. And any kind of stimulus ideas like this could be a generator of employment.
And I just want to give you a flavour of the public response. This is a poll that's currently underway on thejournal.ie, and 58.1% of respondents say they won't use it because it's not worth the hassle. 35% of people say they haven't used it, but they would have if hospitality was open. And just 306 people say they have used it. Now, that it's a straw poll, but I would imagine it's fairly indicative of the general feeling about stay and spend. Part of the problem, Mark, it could be the world's most streamlined system, but if people aren't aware of it, they're not going to use it.
Yeah, absolutely. People need to be aware of this, and it can't be a scenario where you have to fight the dragon to be able to take something. It has to be practical, it has to be user-friendly, and there has to be engagement from the public on this. So all we're asking for anything like this that comes up again is a simple consultation process, which hasn't really happened of late, and we can see that from what's after happening now, the way hotels are opening indoors and restaurants aren't. But if the government engaged a little bit more with us, well then we can cancel out any mishaps, like, you know. So this was a bit of a disaster from the get-go. It never worked. It wasn't fit for purpose. And the next initiative that's brought in, we'd like to be consulted on it so we can try and make things right, make it work for the customer, make it work for the businesses.
Mark McGowan of the Restaurants Association of Ireland, also owner and operator of Scholars Townhouse Hotel in Drogheda, thank you indeed for joining us. What kind of scheme would you like to see used? The stay and spend scheme requires that you have a smartphone, that you have an app, that you keep all your receipts, that you take pictures, that you're signed up to their revenue online system. And for a lot of people, that's grand. That'll work appropriately. But would you like to see vouchers given to each household, a stimulus package to each household, or like Mark said, the Eat Out to Help Out scheme in Northern Ireland and the UK? Let us know. 0833 97 97 97. Joe has gotten in touch. He says, is this stupidity going to end? When you hear politicians saying the science doesn't matter, I haven't heard any of them say that, but regardless, he says they are saying that the science doesn't matter, they're planning does, you know, they haven't a clue what they're doing, and it's a one-sided argument. Thanks for that there, Joe, and I think that Joe's view may have sympathy with others who are listening. 0833 97 97 97. The number of mortgages drawn down by first-time buyers in the first 3 months of this year is at levels not seen since the 2007, the height of the Celtic Tiger, just before the recession began. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Charlie Weston, personal finance editor at the Irish Independent. Charlie, you're welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
Before people get worried, I suppose, that the entire economy is about to fall off a cliff edge, there are a number of differences between this moment in time in mortgage terms and 2007. One would be supply, the other would be people have a lot of pent-up savings. The last year has enabled some people to save thousands more than they would have, thus enabling them to save their deposit. And we have other factors involved there, why people may be going for mortgages now than they weren't 6 months ago, or they may not be in a year.
That's right. We've seen a record number of people, particularly first-time buyers, taking out a mortgage in the first 3 months of this year. We're back to levels not seen since 2007. So the number of first-time buyers in the first 3 months was at the highest level since 2007, so for 14 years. And the overall number of mortgages drawn down, or, you know, houses bought essentially, was about 9,000 for the first 3 months, and that's a 12-year high. So this is extraordinary. And you know, what's going on here? Are we back to the old Celtic Tiger boom times nonsense? Well, we're not really. It's just that the borrowing is a lot safer this time, and banks are not over-lending. You know, you can only borrow, in most cases, unless you get an exemption, 3.5 times your income. You have to have a 10% deposit, so you can't have a 100% mortgage. You know, banks are not being flahula controlling money all over the place the way they were in that crazy time back in the day. So, you know, but what's happening is people have built up pandemic savings, and that's helped them to get a deposit together much faster. So these are the lucky ones, the ones that are still in jobs, who can work from home. You know, they're not in hospitality, they're not in the hairdressers. These are people who can work remotely. They're not going to the pub, they're not going on holidays, they're not going out to the restaurant, so they have extra money. They're building the deposit far quicker than they might have. They might have been waiting till expecting to get the deposit together next year or the year after, but because they haven't been able to spend for 13 months, they have the money together. The other factor, I suppose, Ciara, is that people are not just considering the big cities anymore where property is expensive. They're moving out because they want more space. They might move back where they grew up, and you know, they can work from home. So they might buy a house which is cheaper than you'd buy in a suburb or in the city, but they have a dedicated room for working from home, and they expect that they'll work from home mostly from here on in. So these are all factors that are playing into a market which is kind of booming again in terms of sales and in terms of mortgage drawdowns. But,
well, in terms, absolutely, absolutely, Charlie, I think we all hope that. But absolutely booming in terms of mortgage drawdown. But just because you've drawn down a mortgage doesn't mean you'll be successful in effecting a purchase, because I would wonder, what properties are these people who've drawn down a mortgage in the first quarter of this year going to buy? Because there has been precious little new builds in the last 14 months. We had the Home Builders Association saying that the effects of successive lockdowns on them means that their market, their work, is going to be affected for years to come.
Yeah, no, if they're drawing down the mortgage, Ciara, they're actually buying the property. You know, you don't draw down a mortgage unless you've got something to draw it down on. So these are people who've agreed purchases. You're absolutely right, though, that the it's not new purchases. There's been a real problem there because the building trade has been in lockdown for so long. Essentially, what we're seeing is there's more second-hand homes being bought than new ones. And so that's kind of a reverse of where we were, because the supply just isn't there. So people are buying second-hand homes. They're prepared to put a bit of money into doing them up. And they're probably buying them outside the traditional areas that they would have bought them. And it's surprising they're doing this, because you're not able to view properties in physically at the moment. You know, you have to do it virtually.
That's the extraordinary thing.
Problem. Yeah, if you're buying a second-hand house, you want to see it, don't you? You know?
Well, if you're buying any house or anything, you know, that is a big ticket item in your life, however you define big ticket, you want to see it first.
Yeah, you know, because, I mean, photographs are deceptive. You don't know how big that cupboard is, or, you know, you'll only really get a sense of the condition of it if it's a second-hand house. Once you step inside it, you know, you need to work out where various things you have are going to fit. You know, it's just the bottom base things, like, will my fridge fit into that space? That kind of thing. So, I mean, you know, all of this is happening despite people not being able to view properties, despite the fact that huge numbers are on the PUP payment and others are on wage subsidies and can't get mortgages because of that. And despite the fact that we have virtual viewings and very little new house building. So it's extraordinary that we're having such big numbers of purchases and drawdowns going on at the moment. But that's what we're seeing, and it is something else at the minute.
Are we gearing up then? Should we be bracing ourselves for a notable jump in house prices?
I think that's kind of inevitable. There's pent-up demand there. These pandemic savings, as we call them, you know, those people who are lucky enough to be able to work from home, who are putting aside extra money, they have the money. They just can't find the property. So when you've got money chasing limited property, what you get is prices rising. And we have seen that anyway. The figures up to now have been prices rising. I mean, this time last year, we've been told by all sorts of experts from the Economic and Social Research Institute, you know, to the banks themselves, that property prices will probably collapse. It didn't happen. They've been going up all year. And the expectation is that they will continue to go up. So I'm afraid, you know, if you're trying to buy a house, the prices are going to keep rising. If you're in a house and you have your mortgage, you're probably happy enough to see prices rising. But it is going to continue to be a difficult market for potential buyers. There's no doubt about that.
Charlie Weston, Personal Finance Editor at the Irish Independent. Thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about foreign travel. Now, we're hearing a lot of talk about heading to lands foreign for holidays, perhaps at the end of June. But how practical, how advisable is that? How ready is the aviation industry? I'm joined on the line to discuss this by Owen Curry. He's editor at Air and Travel Extra and, of course, a proud resident of Strathan. Owen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Always a pleasure to talk in Kildare, Ciara.
Well, I tell you who has been full of talk, and that is the European Parliament, who voted to create effectively a COVID passport. What's that going to look like?
It's going to be on your phone. It's not a passport as we traditionally know it. And it's been developed very quickly and at great speed. There were about 17 prototypes floating around when I first covered this back in October. By January, it was narrowed down to two. One of them was trialled already by the Middle Eastern Airlines. Ursula von der Leyen put her weight behind it and said, we're going to deliver this by the spring. And unusually for Europe, they move very fast to this. The Commission came up with it. The Parliament has seen it through. And that sounds all very good. But the next hurdle is where we hit serious turbulence, to use the aviation term, because the member states, each of them, are going to have a separate policy on this.
Oh, God. That sounds like it's going to get very, very tricky. So it's not going to be a smooth, one-size-fits-all, this is the passport, this is how you use it, hop on a plane kind of system.
The south of Europe is really enthusiastic about this. The north of Europe, less so, and France, being France, sort of has making up its mind, but has weighed in behind it. So they have agreed the form of it for that to be used internationally. But where it really impacts on us, Ciara, is that we've been slow. We are the ones that are, you know, really been in the business of trying to close down international access, especially since, understandably, a lot of panic in January. We worked with a grand total of 100,000 COVID cases at the beginning of January. That turned to 200,000. Everybody knows that. But one of the things that happened out of that was the whole international travel debate became circular, and it certainly leaned against anything to encourage people to move within Europe, even within Europe, never mind around
further
the world.
Afield.
So that's where we are, and I suspect that mentality within the Irish government is what will make the difference, whether we adapt it or not, and how quickly we adapt it.
And I would imagine that should we adopt it, we will be late adopters, because we have Tánaiste Leo Varadkar on record as saying June is too soon for widespread international travel to be allowed. And I think Foreign Affairs Minister Simon Coveney is of a similar view. I would imagine their counterparts in Fianna Fáil and the Greens think similarly. So you have effectively most of the cabinet saying June is too early. I cannot see them then turning around to push adoption on an individual basis of this kind of passport.
And that's the key, is how forceful the European Commission will be in saying, lads, we're the same economy, we can't start going our own direction. And, you know, that happened last March. It happened when Italy cases ran out of control and the rest of Europe effectively threw them under the bus. That's the experience of Europe now. There's been a lot of talking and wrangling about that. Do we hold in this together? Do we have a travel policy together? We're one economy, or do we start blaming the neighbouring country? I mean, well, we get a little bit obsessive about Irish policy in this, but we had a situation last summer where Serbia was blaming Montenegro, that Italy and Spain were blaming each other, Finland and Norway were blaming Sweden. But things get very nationalistic and borders and drawbridges when people get frightened. The question really is that there seems to have been a movement across Europe that we're going to live with this. There's going to be an element of risk, but we manage that risk. Ireland hasn't arrived at that, but the reality is we're not that far behind in the debate, and we could see a situation where July is where we start opening and August is where flights resume, and September, October, we're not back to 2019 levels, but pretty much up there. The real key to this, Ciara, is that the aviation industry has held its nerve. The flights are in place. If you look into your internet, obviously short-term, not things that great. The Barcelona service from Dublin by Ryanair stopped completely until the beginning of June. But all of those ambitious flights are there. Frequencies are there for the likes of Malaga. And we have four new destinations to be announced from Dublin this year that weren't there in 2019. The aviation industry is really enthusiastic about this new green passport or the green certification. And they are ready to roll. All they're waiting is for the government here to say, let's get back doing what we used to do and stay connected with the rest of the world.
Now, Ryanair, as is its wont, hasn't put a tooth in it in terms of its commentary on its view from its perspective of the government's attitudes to foreign travel, both outbound and inbound. What, Owen, is the view in the wider international community of Ireland's stance?
Quite critical. Willie Walsh, who is Irish, obviously is the chair or the secretary general of the big international aviation body IATA. That would be the equivalent of FIFA for aviation. It runs world aviation. He says that the world is living with this. Ireland is lagging behind. One of the stats from the Eurostat, the people who run European air traffic control, another Irishman in charge, by the way. Aviation is something we do a lot of. Eamon Brennan, he's in charge of that, the brother of the former minister, Seamus Brennan. His stats show that European aviation, which is one of the worst affected in the world because we've had a bad winter, is down to 65% on what 2019 was. Ireland is down more than 85%. Wow. We're certainly doing more to cut ourselves off. The reality is that it's only April. Like winter is when airlines like Ryanair traditionally lose money. So, you know, not flying a lot isn't going to cost them that much thought. But both Ryanair and Aer Lingus, we really, really depend on them putting the inventory in place. That ambitious schedule that is already in the system that I talked about earlier, making sure that that moves, because they can move their assets elsewhere. Aer Lingus are moving flights to Manchester that would be servicing Irish airports from North America. They can do that very easily. You can't move a hotel, you can move an aircraft very easily. And there are going to be problems rolling out the passport, even if we weren't enthusiastic about it, Ciara, because most European countries have a very evolved database of their the health of their citizens.
And we don't.
We tend not to. We saw that coming up in terms of the rollout of our vaccination programme.
It's going to be very interesting to see at what point and in what way Ireland adopts this COVID travel certification. Owen Carey, as always, thank you indeed for joining us.